In the last lecture, we covered a vast swath of time.
We've lost you, Ben. We've got married twice. Double happiness. Okay. Okay, you're back. Thank you.
Sorry. We're back.
Yeah.
This video conferencing cable can be frustrating at times. I apologise for any technical issues that crop up. So yes, covered a long period of time yesterday or last week, talking about modern Chinese history, specifically from the Opium Wars up until the inauguration of the People's Republic of China in 1949. Today, we're going to cover the period of time from 1949 to the present, talking about the Republic of China's political system and how it's evolved substantially from the inauguration of the PRC up to the present moment. Now, there's two key figures loom large when we talk about the People's Republic of China. One, who you're already familiar with, is Mao Zedong. The second is a man called Deng Xiaoping. Now, today, Mao will be the focus of our lecture and how he converted himself from a revolutionary leader into a national leader and the relative strengths and weaknesses of his personal journey there. Next week, when we talk about the Chinese economy, then we'll talk more about Deng Xiaoping. But he does come up today. Mao Zedong's image is inescapable in China. His influence, his legacy, and the reaction to it are integral to the story of post-1949 politics in China. So here's what I'll cover today, many things. First, we'll have a look at the structure of the People's Republic's political system. Have a look at the nuts and bolts, a brief introduction. This will include looking at the Communist Party itself, as well as the Chinese state, and there's a third organ of power, the People's Liberation Army, that's important to the story, and that'll be mentioned too. Key themes of the period. One, ideological mobilisation. This is really important theme to get your head around when we're talking about Chinese politics. We're looking at the Mao Zedong personality cult, which this is why the existence of this cult is why Mao's figure looms large physically around China as well as metaphorically. We're looking at a streak of anti-intellectualism that runs through Chinese politics in the Mao era, as well as class struggle, another important theme. And then we'll cut that off by looking at the transformation of Chinese politics that's occurred in the post-Mao era after the mid-1970s. So firstly, we'll look at these themes, and then we'll do a chronology of this period from 1949 to the present. And then we'll finish up by evaluating Mao Zedong and his legacy on China. The Chinese Communist Party was established to be the vanguard of the revolutionary classes. Now, who are the revolutionary classes? This means the people. And the people meant to exercise political dictatorship over the counter-revolutionary classes, aka enemies of the state. So who were these enemies of the state? They could be former landlords, business divide, bourgeois people, if you know about Marxist nomenclature, anyone who was thought to have collaborated with the Japanese during the occupation. There's a whole list of potential class enemies that the people's dictatorship was set up to guard against. This occurred because the Chinese Communist Party was set up in the context of the Chinese Civil War. So there is conflict occurring, there are defined military enemies, and once the People's Republic is established, there's still people associated with the defeated factions around. Since 1949, the Chinese Communist Party has attempted to combine its class war revolutionary streak, a combination of this aspect of being a vanguard movement against the enemies of the state, to combine this streak with the responsibilities and roles of actually governing a country. Now, these are two very different roles the Communist Party's had to take on. And the tension between these two roles is very much evident in the Mao Zedong era. This is a difficult task, particularly in the context of a country which, as I've identified before, is embarked on one of the largest human engineering projects in history. So we're going to explore now how this has taken place over time. Now, the government of the People's Republic of China, it's a complicated dance, and it's achieved through three main organs of the Chinese state. One is the Communist Party. The second is the government, or the state, and the third is the People's Liberation Army. So how are they related? You can see the graphic on the slide here. Three very clear hierarchies of power. How are they related? Well, the party is supposed to provide ideological input for policy decisions. The state is supposed to carry out the ideological instructions of the party. So they're the implementers. However, in reality, both the Communist Party and the state are highly integrated. Many of the people who occupy bureaucratic positions within the government are also members of the Communist Party, and this stretches right up the tree of command. Now, your reading for this week is especially instructive about the mechanics of Chinese government, so I suggest that you read this with some care. It'll go into this in more detail. What you should note, if you look at the graphic on the slide, is the sheer size of the government bureaucracy in China. 70 million plus members of the Communist Party, 200 million plus government bureaucrats, and then you've got over 2.3 million members of the People's Liberation Army. I mean, this is a staggering size for a state bureaucracy. If we consider the third arm of the PLA, the size of the military and its role in politics has declined a little bit since the 1990s. The PLA became professionalised, which means less based on ideology, more based on strict military doctrine and training, and its leaders were distanced from the political decision-making process. And in part this occurred because many of its leaders from the revolutionary era either began to die or retire, and through generational change, they were not as associated with the political apparatus of the state. Here's another graphic that shows you how the three organs of the state are related. This is a bit more of a flowchart. You can see it's quite integrated and quite complicated. The executive, so that's the government. So if you remember this, every state has three arms. Right, the executive branch, which is the actual government itself, the legislative arm, which is the officials that are elected, so to speak. China has one, but how the officials come into place or are installed in their positions is not democratic unless you go right down to the bottom of the tree, the local village level, and village heads do go through some kind of election process there. But the executive, let's look at the executive, that's where the real action is here. The president is a man called Hu Jintao. You will probably have seen him on the news. If you haven't, keep a lookout. The vice president is a man called Zhang Qinhong. And the premier is a man called Wen Jiabao. Now, the names are on the slide. I know some of you in Bundura were hoping that I would write down some of the names on the slide. I've tried to accommodate that wish because I know Chinese names can be complicated. So they're up there. So these three men are sort of the chief operators at the top of this hierarchy. And particularly for the president, Hu Jintao, he's the one with the picture on the slide, he holds top positions in the upper echelon of both the party and the government. So his position, often in Chinese politics, is called that of the paramount leader because he's right at the top of the tree. Just under him in the party is the Standing Committee of the Politburo. This is a committee that's occupied by nine men, the nine most powerful men in the Chinese state. And we'll talk about that a little bit more shortly. At the provincial and the local levels, officials here enjoy significant autonomy from the central bureaucratic structure. And because they enjoy autonomy, this is also the site of most of the corruption that occurs in the Chinese state, because their decision-making is somewhat detached from the core. And there's an interesting finding that I came across recently, is that many Chinese who are campaigning against corruption are doing so at the provincial and at the local level, but they're still quite happy with the central government. They think the central government's doing a good job, but they're unhappy with how local officials are administering things. But let's come back to the Politburo Standing Committee for a moment. The Chinese political system is not dependent on the man, completely dependent on the person who is right at the top of the hierarchy. And particularly after the Mao Zedong era, the Chinese state is ruled by a committee, if you like, a collective leadership, and this is what the Politburo Central Committee is. The men you see on the slide are the current members of the Politburo Standing Committee. President Hu Jintao is pictured in the centre of the lineup here. The leader in waiting, the man who's going to take over from Hu Jintao later in the year, is a man called Xi Jinping, and he's pictured second from the right. He's quite a tall man. So yes, the Standing Committee, it's the central decision-making body in the Chinese government. It meets every 7 to 10 days, so almost on a weekly basis. It also meets in secret, so its deliberations, its decision-making processes, the debates that occur within it, these are not made public. What they do in these meetings is to make modifications and give final approval to recommendations that are made from the various bureaucratic organs of the state. So, from the government ministries, from relevant arms of the Communist Party, they give advice. The Politburo Central Standing Central Committee has ultimate authority to execute these policies. So this is a very important body. I also just mentioned the idea that the person at the head of the Chinese bureaucratic hierarchy is called the paramount leader. Now, China's had five of these since the advent of the PRC in 1949. The paramount leader combines the three positions: is the head of the executive, president of the government, and general secretary of the Communist Party. When the person combines those three titles, they become the paramount leader. So who were they? The first one is Mao Zedong. He was succeeded briefly by a man called Hua Guofeng, and he was Mao's anointed successor, but he ended up being muscled out by Deng Xiaoping. After Deng retired, his successor was a man called Jiang Zemin, who really presided over the takeoff of China's economic boom in the 1990s. And after Jiang, Hu Jintao becomes the successor till today. The incoming leader, Xi Jinping, is pictured at the bottom of the slide. So get used to his face, because we'll be seeing a lot more of him in the coming years. Let's learn more about Xi, the incoming leader. He was a Communist Party bureaucrat. He got his start at the local level with positions in Fujian province. He also had provincial leadership positions in Zhejiang province and in the Shanghai Special Administrative Region. He's currently the sixth-ranked member of the Politburo Standing Committee, so the sixth most powerful man in China. He's soon to rise to number one. He emerged as Hu's anointed successor in 2010. And this is the usual pattern. As a leadership succession looms on the horizon a few years beforehand, factions within the Communist Party elite will begin to jockey for power, and eventually a designated successor will emerge and take over the reins. So that's a brief introduction to the structure. As I said, goes through the readings, it explains the structure in some detail. In the lecture here, I'm just trying to give you an overview. So how does it work in practice? There's differences between the Mao and the Dun periods. And we're going to explore some key things before we run through this chronology. I'm also going to be using some Marxist class classifications, which we need to understand if we're going to get with some of the language that I'm going to use. These will come up in discussion. So, the peasants, the bottom of the tree, these are usually subsistence farmers who were traditionally bonded to a landlord. So they had to work in one place, live and work in one place under a landlord. Then we have the proletariat. This means ordinary workers who work for someone else. We have the bourgeoisie. Now these are the people that employ, that own the means of production, who employ the workers, or they're the landlords who employ the peasants. A small offshoot of the bourgeoisie is something we call the petty bourgeoisie. And these are people who are tradesmen or small shop owners. People that own their own business, but don't really employ that many people, and they're not big-time players. So these are four class distinctions to keep in mind as we, particularly when we talk about class struggle and class enemies, these are important designations to keep in the back of our minds. Now, theme number one, the role of ideology is key to understanding Chinese politics, particularly in the Mao era. So what does official ideology do? Well, it serves certain functions. For one, it legitimizes the control of the Communist Party. It provides a justification for the Communist Party to exist as the definer of national objectives. This is, if we're the Communist Party, this is why we have this position. This justifies our rule. Ideology also helps articulate what a government's objectives are. It informs the specific programs that help mobilise the people to achieve national objectives. And it's also a vehicle for the indoctrination of people. So ideology gets people to internalise those national objectives and internalise the right of the Communist Party to define what those objectives are. So, three or four very important functions there. And of course, the Communist Party utilised ideology in a big way in ideological mobilisation campaigns, specific programs to get the people involved in achieving national objectives. Now, power is highly centralised around one person. That leader needs to be elevated beyond the status of ordinary people. Which leads us to theme number two, and this is the Mao Zedong personality cult. This personality cult presented Mao as a revolutionary hero. So, we think of Mao Zedong thought, the Little Red Book, and I'll talk about this a little more later. A personality cult presents Mao as, or any totalitarian leader for that matter, as the fount of wisdom, a philosopher king who knows all, and can deliver the people from any ill that befalls them. It also positions Mao as the father of the nation. We think of, in Chinese culture, the Confucian hierarchy. And in tutorials, if you want to talk about the five Confucian relationships, that's a good discussion point for understanding this. Now, the personality cult reached its peak during the Cultural Revolution, during the time that people were waving this little book around in a big way. And I'll talk about this more soon. But today, the cult of Mao has subsided somewhat since his death and since the country and the economy has changed since the mid-1970s. Now, free initiative or free thought in any field or any activity that is entirely predictable is a threat to the total exercise of power. Here we have theme number three, anti-intellectualism. So the persecution of intellectuals, of educated people, people with technical skills, these people in a totalitarian regime can present a threat to total power and the quest for total domination. Free thinking does not always conform with the total commitment to official ideology that's necessary in such systems. You have to present yourself as 100% committed to the official ideology of the state. And this is a lot more difficult for people who are educated, people with a critical mind. So if you're a totalitarian dictator, people with this kind of education can become your target. Now, through various ideological campaigns through the Mao period, intellectuals and scholars lost their high status in society. Sometimes they became working class functionaries. Or worse, they were struggled against or purged. Now, struggling, self-criticism. This is a ritual that has occurred in a lot of communist countries where people will work in small work teams at their workplace or in small student groups like your own. And they'll meet every so often, maybe once a week, maybe more, maybe less. And each person in that group will have to get up in front of the group and confess their sins for the week. And then everyone else in the group will denounce them and say things that they've done wrong too. And then they'll have to give some kind of penitence and promise to be more devoted to the official ideology and the official doctrines of the leader. Now, the purpose of struggling, the purpose of self-criticism, is to make develop an atmosphere of distrust, so that you can't trust the people around you, you can't trust friends, you can't trust work colleagues, you can't trust family. The only person you can trust is the leader. The state is your only path from deliverance, because everyone else could denounce you and get you into trouble. So this is a very effective means of totalitarian control. And of course, if you're an intellectual and your crimes against the state or your class crimes are really bad, then you could be purged from your position, sent to prison camps, or possibly executed in extreme cases. So what's the result? Well, intellectual activity gets devalued. It stifles scientific advancement. It stifles technological development and technological innovation. So this has a direct impact on economic development. If you don't have people with technical or scientific skills, it's really hard to innovate. It's really hard to advance an economy in the modern world. And this is the thing. This is what we saw in China at the end of the Mao period. An example of this is a saying called red over expert. Now, red meaning communist. It was often said that it was better to be red or well-versed in the thought, the official ideology and the thought of Mao Zedong, than it was to be a technical expert or an intellectual or an educated person, at the risk of being labelled class enemy. Now, an example of one such campaign relates to a young man called Lei Feng. Now, Lei Feng was a PLA soldier who died at the age of 21 in an accident in 1963. He was identified in official ideology as the model soldier. And lots of mobilisation campaigns, ideological campaigns, called the Learn from Comrade Lei Feng campaign. His thoughts were published in a diary called Lei Feng's Diary. And the diary was held up as a model of how Chinese citizens should behave and should act and should be devoted to the official ideology of the state. Some of the traits in the diary were modesty, selflessness and devotion to the official ideology, and devotion to the practice of Mao Zedong thought. Now, in more recent times, Leifeng's exploits have been disputed, and there is some evidence to suggest that much of what appears in his diary has been fabricated. But nonetheless, his image and his life was mobilised as an ideological rallying point that people should aspire to. So what are some of the impacts of a commitment to being read over expert? Well, people were put to work on tasks related to ideological and political mobilisation rather than the practical tasks for which they were trained. So imagine that for a minute. Imagine that you are a scientist and you devote a large portion of your time to learning about Mao Zedong's thought, communist ideology. That's time that you're not spending advancing your own field. That's time, if you're in another position, that you're not devoting to actually carrying out your task. It's non-productive time. So again, this has economic implications. It has organisational implications. For intellectuals, this alienated them from foreign sources of information, and it quarantined them from important scientific and intellectual developments from overseas. It also meant that the party itself became resistant to new ideas, and it became capable only of applying ideological solutions to complex technical problems. And of course, this meant a lot of the solutions that the party came up with were poor solutions, because they were not based in scientific reality. Now, theme number four, class struggle. And class struggle is the cornerstone of permanent revolution. To maintain a permanent revolution, there has to be an enemy. You can't be revolting against nothing. So in communist countries, the enemy of the revolution is always a class enemy in various guises. This could be rightists or right-wingers, capitalists, intellectuals, imperialists, the bourgeois classes, the landlords. There's a long list of variously designated class enemies. Now, these enemies of the state contrasted with the people. And the people is anyone loosely defined as being loyal to the Communist Party. Political attitude was the key to the concept of class struggle. So, again, this relates back to being read over expert. If you were red and you were known as being red, then that very much helped your class designation. So you can see on the graphics what happens to people who are designated as enemies of the state. And these are quite harrowing images. Public humiliation, beatings and violence, the loss of face. It's an incredible period. You would not want to be a class enemy at this time. So we move from that to this. Theme number five, which is the transformation of China in the post-Mao Zedong era. So on the graphic, you see high-rise buildings filled skylines. You see dockyards filled with container ships, containers full of products for export on ships. You see China's first female astronaut. You see the renminbi, or the people's currency. These are all emblematic of China's rapid economic development and social transformation in the post-Mao Zedong era. So there's several themes to this period. One is that there's less emphasis on ideology and more on pragmatism. So there's a quote that's often attributed to Deng Xiaoping. It doesn't matter whether the cat is black or white, so long as it catches the mouse. Now, Mao Zedong said this of Deng Xiaoping during the Cultural Revolution. But what he was getting at is that Deng Xiaoping was a pragmatist who was less concerned with ideology and more concerned with actually getting things done. And this trait definitely comes out as Deng Xiaoping asserts more control in the leadership structure of the Chinese state. We see in this period market reforms to the economy, both from above as government policy, but more often than not from below. People adapting to changing circumstances, and then the government sees what's going on and then legitimises them after the fact. We see rapid increases in wealth and increases in the standard of living for many Chinese, lifting them out of poverty. But at the same time, we also see quite a growth in socio-economic disparities. And again, the first lecture I gave on the diversity in China delved into this more deeply. And a major theme of this period is a struggle to maintain unity of a diverse and rapidly changing country. Old contradictions give way to new ones. The old contradictions of an ideologically structured society that didn't really work give way to the new contradictions of the market economy and the type of problems that this brings about in such a diverse land. Alright, so they're the key themes. Now let's go through a chronology of events and see how these themes play out in practice. Just give me a moment.
They are
turn people against each other. So you may think, why would you want people to turn against each other in a country that's so diverse and fractured? Well, if they're aiming their venom at each other, they're very easy to control from above. So that power objective is very clear. But in doing so, they're also trying to align the citizenry behind the leader. So again, if the people at the bottom are arguing or denouncing or fighting with each other, they can only find salvation from the leader above. So what's the first? Let's look at the first mobilisation campaign. And this came very early on as a consequence of the Korean War. It was called Resist United States and Aid Korea. And here I've got an old service medal, Chinese service medal from the Korean War, that has various slogans talking about this campaign. Now, the idea here was to support China's communist ally in North Korea. Mao Zedong did say at this period that China and North Korea were as close as lips and teeth. Indeed, Mao lost his own son, who died fighting in the Korean War. But the other goal of this was to forge national unity in relation to an external enemy. So again, if you've got a diverse and fractured society, one way to get them to think that they're part of a cohesive whole is to present them with an enemy that threatens all of them. And the USA, during the Korean War, fulfilled this task, fulfilled this objective. Another thing that Mao did at this time was engage in a series of purges. So he tried to get rid of anti-communist groups and secret societies. So there could have been more than between 800,000 to 10 million executions at this time. And Mao said to have remarked about this, to make an omelette, one must break some eggs. They had to weed out these dissenting forces. Remember, you've got remnants here from the Civil War period, people that were not friends of the Communist Party were still there. There was the Sanfan campaign, or the three antis: anti-corruption, anti-waste, anti-bureaucracy. And this was targeted at party officials. So there were deemed to be some class enemies within the Communist Party bureaucracy in the 1950s. There was the Wufan campaign, or the five antis. These were against bribery, tax evasion, theft of government property, fraud and theft of state economic secrets. And these were targeted at the bourgeois classes. So you've got people within and outside of the Communist Party bureaucracy who are being targeted as elements of as enemies of the state to be removed to try and consolidate the leader's power. More pragmatically at this time, the Chinese government engaged in many campaigns of standardisation. So to overcome the linguistic diversity of the country, they came up with the Pudonghua, the people's common speech, and that's what we know as common Mandarin today, the one that you will learn in classes here in Australia. Written press was simplified into a common script that was used by everyone. There was a common national currency, the renminbi, the people's currency, and this replaced a series of regional currencies that existed around the country prior to that. And the idea was that you foster unity by standardising all these common measures, units of currency, language, and so forth. You bring the country together despite its diversity. Now, one thing that you see in China during the early communist period, and elsewhere in communist countries once they've come to power, is that you see something called land reform, where land is taken away from landlords or big landholders and distributed among the peasants. And this happened in China. It began before the end of the Civil War in areas that were controlled by the communists, but it was accelerated everywhere else after the victory. And because the Communist Party had promised this in the Civil War, this is one of the things that gave them great appeals to the peasantry. Because the peasants understood that they were going to get some land as a result of their support for the Communists once the Communists won. However, those initial land reforms, not just in China but elsewhere across the Communist world, gave way reasonably quickly. And the peasants were then organised into things, entities called collective farms. And these are large state-run farms where farmers were employed in the same way as they would be if they were working in a factory. So they were no longer owners of the land. They were the owners of the land, it was the state. And the farmers were then working for the state as employees. So this was, for one reason, this was an ideological move. This makes the land, the people who work the land, more proletarian and less prone to bourgeois sympathy, less prone to want to increase their land holdings and act as if they were owners of the means of production. But there are also efficiency goals. It was thought that by making farms bigger, they could achieve economies of scale and therefore make their operations more efficient. So if we fast forward to the late 1950s, it's been a decade since the Communist Party's victory over the Kuomintang. And a number of reforms have been instituted. The society is changing. And the Communist Party briefly loosened its conformist standards and revolutionary discipline to allow some criticism of the government. And this was known as what's called the Hundred Flowers Campaign. Now, the Communist Party leadership miscalculated here. They thought they would get some gentle criticisms which would help them to run the country in a better manner. What happened, though, this was ended up being a pressure release valve of tensions that had built up from the rapid changes of the collectivisation of agriculture and other reforms that had taken place over the preceding 10 years. So Mao said, let 100 flowers bloom, let 100 schools of thought contend. This is how he positioned his campaign. Now initially, there was no response from anyone in the public. People had seen what had happened to people who'd been purged, people who'd been executed or sent away to gulags. And so there was a great fear. No one wanted to say anything that would be critical of the state. Then we had some mild criticism. When people made some friendly suggestions and requested access to information from abroad that might help them in their day-to-day operations. And then once the ball started rolling, then you started to see more fiery criticism. People became more bold in the criticisms that they were making of the Communist Party and how well they were running the show. And eventually, the Communist Party was stunned by just how virulent these criticisms had become, and this prompted them to put an end to the Hundred Flowers campaign, putting a break on these suggestions and bring in something called the Anti-Rights Campaign in 1957. Now, this is the Communist Party's reaction to these criticisms. They've identified over 300,000 people as rightists, including many of China's most talented intellectuals. So the people that had spoken out during the Hundred Flowers campaign had been blacklisted and called anti-rightists, class enemies. Rightists, I should say, not anti-rightists. So what are the punishments for these people? There's jail, or there's reform through hard labour at political re-education camps, or gulags. They could be banished to rural areas, so intellectuals from the city might get sent out to work on farms. They could be tortured. They could be executed. Some people who'd been labelled as righteous committed suicide under the strain. So, in fact, it cements the Communist Party's position in power, However, it guts the Chinese intelligentsia, and it reduces the nation's technical expertise. Now, as a continuation of the anti-rightist movement, and one we have similar results, Mao wanted to remove reactionary elements from within the Communist Party, a common theme. And there was something called the Four Cleanup movement from the late 50s to the early 60s. The Four Cleanups focused on four areas: politics, economics, organisation, and ideology. And some of these were truly bizarre. So we had one, just the four pests campaign. You can see a visualisation of it on the propaganda poster on the slide, where the government proclaimed that the people should try and kill and exterminate any pests that were eating or damaging the crops and reducing agricultural yield. So they went after sparrows, they went after rats, and various other vermin. Flies, mosquitoes, because they robbed the people of the fruits of their labour. Many other types of birds were killed too, so you can imagine anything with wings was a target under the fervour of a mobilisation campaign. Now, the unfortunate thing was that in killing all these birds, it removed many of the natural predators of insects that feasted upon crops. So in the end, more crops were damaged by insects eating them than what the birds were doing, because there were no natural predators for the insects. So it's a unfortunate irony of that campaign. At about the same time, we have one of China's most famous or infamous ideological mobilisation campaigns, the Great Leap Forward. And this was an attempt to transform China's backward agricultural economy into a modern industrial economy during the 1958-61 four-year plan. Now, there's several aspects to this, and I'll go through them in turn. One was the establishment of people's communes. So during the land reform period, we had the collective farms, where individual landholders had their land appropriated by the state. They were turned into agricultural factories, if you like. The people's communes were enlargements of this. So individual collective farms were grouped into huge communes. And there were three primary reasons for this. Now, one was to increase productivity. The same rationales about economies of scale came into play here. They wanted to transform privately owned farms into a version of the state-owned factory, so a continuation of the land reform period. A second aim was to bolster the bureaucratic power of the state. So, moving the management of these large-scale communes to inside of the state bureaucracy, rather than having them as semi-autonomous. They're more neatly compartmentalised into the power structure of the state, so theoretically they're easier to control. And they made the peasants who worked in them just as dependent on the state as other sections of society. So that's a really important point. And the third reason is ideological. So collectivisation and then moving agriculture into communes removes private property as something that peasants can aspire to or the ownership of. So have a look at some of the pictures on the slide here. They're quite striking and they're emblematic of what I'm about to talk about. So the Great Leap Forward is not just about agricultural reforms. Intellectuals and party officials were sent to work in the countryside on these or in these communal farms so that they would understand the plight of the masses. Of course, this is also a punishment for being identified as a class enemy. We see village-level industrialisation. So if you look at the graphic on the bottom left of the slide, you see what's called the people's furnaces. is where the people at the village level were encouraged to produce steel in these people's furnaces, because there was a great steel shortage, particularly in rural China. People were encouraged to melt down anything of steel, anything of iron that they had, melt them down in these furnaces so that they could make steel for other production purposes. And this also decreased the need for the government to invest in large factories elsewhere. Financial resources were scarce, and this was thought that the people's furnaces was a shortcut to industrialisation that would subvert the need for large-scale investment in productive facilities. Now, look at the picture. Do these look like something that's going to produce high-quality steel? No, that's not what happened. So they were technologically crude. They tried to maximise China's abundant manpower and try and overcome that technological disadvantage. The iron and steel that was produced in the furnaces was essentially unusable. So a lot of productive hours were devoted to producing something that was useless. A lot of farmers had left the land to go and work in the people's furnaces. So if they're not on the land, they're not helping to produce crops. A lot of the tools that farmers used on the land were smelted down in the people's furnaces. So there's even less there's less tools available for the farmers to use to till the crops. So not surprisingly, we see an agricultural downturn. Food production begins to dip at this time. And we end up with a famine that kills approximately 8 million people, which is the official estimate. Other sources have said it could be as high as 20 million people that died during the Great Leap Forward. And then on the bottom right hand of the slide, you can see some people that look malnourished and in a fair amount of distress. So as a result of the Great Leap Forward, Mao accepted the blame for getting things wrong. And he stepped down as China's head of state, though he did retain his high position in the Communist Party. So he's no longer the paramount leader for a while, but he still has a ranking position in the Communist Party. And he's replaced as the Communist Party chairman by Liu Shaoqi. And Liu Shaoqi was a more pragmatic figure, thought that the Great Leap Forward was overly ideological and wanted to reform the economy. Now, let's fast forward a few years. Mao is no longer the paramount leader of the Chinese state. There is a pragmatist faction that is in control, but Mao wants to reassert his position as the dominant figure in Chinese politics. And the Cultural Revolution, begun in 1966, was he and his supporters' means of climbing back to the pinnacle of power in China. So what were their goals? As usual with these campaigns, it was to remove capitalist and traditionalist elements from Chinese society. And by that, they're referring specifically to the pragmatic faction that's in control of the state at the time. They want to reimpose Maoist ideological orthodoxy over the Communist Party itself. And they want to restore Mao as the paramount leader of the Chinese state. So it's in this time, during the Cultural Revolution, that we see the real explosion of the Mao Zedong personality cult. And also his famous swim in the Yangtze River in 1966, where he gets down to his underpants and has a swim in the river with TV cameras rolling, because there was a rumour that he had passed away or he'd gone into hiding. So he came out to proclaim himself very much alive and begin the Cultural Revolution and this movement to reassert his control. So Mao mobilised young people as the vanguard of his attempt to reclaim power. These were called the Red Guards. Now look at them on the slide. Look at their faces. These are young people just like you, for the most part, your age or younger, or, you know, teenagers, 17, 16, 15, 14 years old. These are children also of the pure classes. These are children of the people. So they're children of workers, of peasants, of soldiers or party officials, or of people who had been revolutionaries during the Civil War. So they're of the appropriate class designation. And what happened? Has anyone been to a rock concert? Or a concert with some horrible band like One Direction or something that whips teenage girls, 14-year-old girls, into a crazy fervor? Well, imagine that, but exponentially more intense. And this is the kind of fervor that you get from the Red Guards. High emotional pitch, highly motivated. They've got their little Bible here, the little red book. They're angry, they're armed with clubs. They're running as mobs with no one controlling them. They're attacking people who were figures of authority. And they're looking for vengeance. I mean, this is an extremely dangerous period in Chinese history. But what about this little red book? Very interesting read if you can get hold of one. It's a selection of quotes attributed to Mao Zedong, which was compiled by Defence Minister Lin Biao in the mid-1960s. 6 billion of these were printed and distributed. And that's why they're relatively easy to get for foreigners, because there's just so many of them floating around, and you can still buy them in China today. Now, having one of these and waving it around in public is a marker of, or was a marker of, one's loyalty to Mao Zedong and commitment to Mao Zedong thought. That's why you look at these pictures, everyone's got a little red book. But let's look at some of the dimensions of the Cultural Revolution. One of these is a campaign called the Abolition of the Four Olds. So, old customs, old culture, old habits, and old ideas. The idea here was to link the class enemies of Mao and the Chinese state, to link them with the corruption and abuses associated with the late Qing dynasty and the capitalist sympathies of the Kuomintang. So Mao saying the people that we're attacking, they are equivalent to the imperial China. They're equivalent to the nationalists. They're equivalent to the enemies of the Chinese state. They are enemies of the Chinese state. Now, unfortunately, as you can see on the picture here, many of China's precious cultural artifacts from this period went up in smoke. Many museums were looted. Religious institutions were ransacked. So a large portion of China's cultural heritage was destroyed, which is one of the great cultural crimes of the 20th century. Take in for a moment the gravity of this photo. Put yourself in the position of the guys with the signs wrapped around their necks. Put yourself in the position of the gentleman holding them there. Put yourself in the position of the people in the crowd. You can see there's more little red books have been held up there. So people were forced to perform self-criticism in front of this huge mob. They were forced to list off their sins, their crimes against the revolution. Whether they were real or not, and often they were not, it was very much a witch hunt. As the mob, these enormous crowds, hurled insults at them, or worse. So under such pressure, you can imagine, people would denounce each other to try and avoid the kind of fate that befell the gentleman in these slides. Some people committed suicide rather than submit to this. take matters into their own hands and would beat up and kill the people that they were struggling against. Well, they murdered suspected enemies of the revolution. So also imagine at this time, if you're someone that has grudges against other people and you want them out of the way, you can denounce them and they're gone. So a lot of that happened. But then, of course, you were exposed to that as well. So it was a really horrible time to be anyone who was remotely associated as a class enemy of the Chinese state. And for the most part, the people that were responsible for this violence were the Red Guards. It was these young people your age, who were murdering, who were persecuting people of intelligence. So really, one of the results is that it inverts the power hierarchy. Anyone who was in a position of authority was liable to be denounced by these young people who had the power. Now, of course, when this happens, your economy grinds to a halt. Economic production shuts down. Farms shut down. Workplaces become battlefields between rival factions. And this is really a period of chaos. And China is almost on the brink of civil war during this period. The military is backing off, letting things play out, but there is anarchy on the streets for the most part. So millions of people were purged from the positions of authority during the Cultural Revolution. And again, this theme of anti-intellectualism comes up. So anyone with any technical expertise, anyone with experience in running a bureaucracy, or having scientific or technical knowledge, these are people who get purged. So again, you see, China's intellectual capital is repeatedly assaulted, up to and including the Chinese, Cultural Revolution. Your knowledge base breaks down, technical expertise is clawed back, it makes it hard to innovate, it makes it hard to develop. And again, look at the faces, look how young these kids are in these photos. So there's two facets to the Cultural Revolution. One is that state authority effectively broke down during this period. I've just talked about that. The other important point is that there's a leadership succession struggle going on here. There's a leadership succession contest. So Mao is getting old. It's known that he's getting ill. And factions are queuing up to see who is going to succeed him as the leader. So one faction is a radical faction headed by Li Biao and the Gang of Four. And the Gang of Four are pictured here on the slide, one of whom is Mao's final wife, Jiang Qing. Li Biao and the Gang of Four helped Mao to set the Cultural Revolution in motion. And they had the most to gain from the Cultural Revolution succeeding. On the other side, you had a left-leaning faction, a more pragmatic faction headed by Zhou Enlai and Deng Xiaoping. And you also had Mao's anointed successor, Hua Guofeng, who was trying to position himself as leader. And for a while, he was China's leader through the late 70s. But this is how it played out. Li Biao, who was defense minister in the 60s and in the Cultural Revolution, he seemed to have played out his usefulness to Mao. He was no longer useful as an agitator. Li realized this, tried to flee to the Soviet Union, but over Mongolia, his plane crashed and he died in mysterious circumstances. Now, yes, it is thought that this was no accident that Mao was responsible for his assassination. The Gang of Four, they attempted to assume power after Mao's death in 1976, but they were ultimately thwarted, and they were arrested and imprisoned in 1981 by Deng Xiaoping. Zhou Enlai, who had been a revolutionary right from the beginning of the Communist Party, had been on the long march with Mao, had been an important figure in the Chinese Communist Party hierarchy throughout the revolution. He died in 1976 But hit champions don't shout him as the man who should take over
the reins of the state.
So he deals Deng Xiaoping into the succession game. The man who Mao said should be his successor, Hua Guofeng, he gets muscled out by Deng Xiaoping. He doesn't have much internal power. So the end result is that by 1981, Deng Xiaoping has assumed control as paramount leader of the Chinese state. So the Communist Party was decimated by the purges of the Cultural Revolution. And so understandably, I think, there was a rank-and-file support for a move away from constant revolution and ideological mobilisation and class struggle. And the members of the Communist Party were championing a more pragmatic response to the country's problems of governance. And this is something that Deng Xiaoping was very much at the vanguard of. So what we see in the Deng Xiaoping era is that the Communist Party's legitimacy starts to move away from ideological fidelity and becomes increasingly dependent on raising people's standard of living. So after Mao's death, the political environment is very much ripe for a reformer to step in. Deng Xiaoping fits the bill. He has revolutionary pedigree. He was there in the Civil War. He was there in 1949. Had been a high functionary through the party throughout this period. Although he had been purged 3 times, he keeps coming back. And he's able to do this because he's well connected across the party. He's well connected within the military. And is respected as a pragmatic leader. He's been a pragmatic figure for a long time, and people realise that at this particular historical moment, he fits the bill. Under his reign, we see the beginnings of economic reform, something called the four modernisations. Modernisation of agriculture, the modernisation of industry, of national defence, and the modernisation of science and technology. Now, these were first outlined by Zhou Enlai in the 1960s, but Deng becomes their champion. Particularly in 1978, once Deng starts to assert his dominance, he kickstarts the reform movement at that time. Something is called socialism with Chinese characteristics. So really, at heart, this is an incremental move towards the market economy and an opening to foreign ideas. It's an opening to foreign technology and investment. But this all occurs within the political framework of the one-party state. So economic reform, but not political reform per se. Now, I don't want to go any further and talk about these reforms because I'm going to get into that in more detail next week. So let's move on. And let's look at the most controversial chapter of the Deng era. And this is the Tiananmen Square incident in 1989. So we're all familiar with Tank Man. We're all broadly familiar with what happened. But what's the broader context? So this is the important point. This was a broad-based protest movement. So it attracted millions of people to Beijing and also to other cities. It wasn't restricted to the capital. These people came from different social groups and different backgrounds. It began in April 1989, and it lasted 7 weeks until the famous crackdown on June 4th of that year, when the tanks came in. So what was driving this protest movement? There's a lot of things going on at the time. And one is that Deng's economic reforms were having consequences, socio-economic consequences. They were unleashing economic forces that were beginning to harm people. So workers were protesting against changes that the reforms had brought. There was inflation. There was unemployment because the state-owned companies or state-owned productive enterprises were starting to sack people. So there was growing unemployment. And also we're getting, you know, the story of official corruption is very much alive at this period too, and it's a common complaint. There were social forces unleashed by a loosening of Mao's totalitarian controls. So students and intellectuals were appealing for more political reforms. They were demanding more freedoms. Freedom of the press, freedom of association, more transparent governance. And another driver of this movement is there's a disagreement within the Communist Party hierarchy about the direction of the reform process. So you have hardliners on the one hand who want to restrict the reforms, go back to the more Maoist-inspired economic arrangement, versus reformers who wanted to continue Deng Xiaoping's work and further open up the economy. So all of these three currents are swirling around. That's why it's a broad-based movement. The economic changes are affecting the workers. The loosening of political freedoms are energising students and intellectuals, giving them freedom they hadn't enjoyed in the PRC period. And then you've got this power struggle within the Communist Party leadership about which way they should go. Now everyone's seen this picture. This is Tang Nan. This is a well-known symbol internationally of the Communist Party's reaction to the Tiananmen protests. The Communist Party ended up interpreting the protest movement as a threat to its legitimacy and a threat to the integrity of the Chinese one-party state. So the hardliners ended up winning the contest within the party about how to react to this protest movement. Now, it's only been just over a decade since the Cultural Revolution. So these people are scared that they're going to go back to the Cultural Revolution and its excesses. So they're very keen on suppressing the protests with military force to make sure that that doesn't happen. Unlike during the Cultural Revolution, which was allowed to escalate out of control because the military didn't step in. So what's the aftermath for this? Well, for one, the protest movements as a whole demonstrate how much Chinese society had changed since the end of the Mao Zedong era. There were widespread arrests of the protest leaders and the students who took part in it. The party structure, although fearful that this was a threat to its legitimacy, weathered the protests and the challenge to its authority. But it also reinforced the fear within the Chinese political classes, a fear of reform, a fear that reform was dangerous and could splinter the Chinese state and bring down the Communist Party. So, because the hardliners win this internal contest, the reformist faction, Communist Party members of this faction are purged. So the most famous example is a man called Zhao Ziyang, who was the head of the reformist faction, and he was placed under house arrest until 2005 when he passed away. And it reinforced the perception that any political threats to the party and to the state should be met with terminal force, with a military reaction, rather than trying to address underlying causes. So why hasn't there been another protest movement of this size in China? Well, there's two reasons. One is that the crackdown worked. That the Communist Party established a priesthood, a political red line, and that has deterred future protest movements. Now another interpretation is that the Chinese economic miracle took off. People are more satisfied with this living standards have been raised. And they're happy with their newfound prosperity. Let's move on now. Deng Xiaoping retire as China's paramount leader in 1992, Jiang Zemin takes over what's called the third generation leadership. Now, Jiang comes to prominence because he succeeds Zhao Ziyang, the man who's been purged because of Tiananmen. He was the Communist Party General Secretary. Jiang Zemin steps in and succeeds him, and this is his springboard to become the next leader. So, Jiang's achievements as Chinese leader. He oversees China's rapid explosion of economic growth in the 1990s. Dutch reforms start to bear fruit, and the Chinese economic miracle really takes off during this period. He starts to oversee the incorporation of a new entrepreneurial class into the Communist Party. The economic miracle is starting to breed the very kind of bourgeois class enemies that during the Mao period the state was trying to get rid of. Now they're being embraced into the fold. China weathered the 1997 Asian financial crisis under Jiang's watch. He presided over the return of Hong Kong and Macau to Chinese sovereignty, territories that had been ceded from China to European powers during the Opium War period. He also improved relations with the United States, which was no mean feat. Now, criticisms of Jiang. One, that he was a political opportunist who profited from the chaos of the Tiananmen Square incident. Another criticism, that he betrayed China's ideological traditions of communism. And that he pursued economic growth at all costs, in spite of the socio-economic income disparities and social problems and environmental degradation that this was causing. And corruption, as another thing was said, that he was criticised for allowing this to explode under his watch. Which brings us to the fourth generation leadership of Hu Jintao. So Hu was another Communist Party technocrat. He'd worked his way up the Communist Party hierarchy through his career. He doesn't have any revolutionary pedigree. So Jiang and Hu, these guys were not part of, did not fight in the Civil War. They weren't, don't have any revolutionary history they can fall back on. They're technocrats, they're bureaucrats. And this represents a real generational change within the party, from the old guards to the new. So what are Hu's achievements? Well, he manages China's continued high economic growth, and now to a point where China is now the second largest economy in the world. Under Hu's watch, China cements its place as a global power, returning back to the heady days prior to the Opium Wars, when China was indeed the Middle Kingdom. Hu tried to pursue a more balanced economic development model, trying to address some of the problems that the explosive growth of the Jiang Zemin era leaves behind. So he attempted to promote development in the regional provinces away from the coastal strip. He displays an awareness of China's social problems, and he's promoted a doctrine called the harmonious society. And you can see there's a sign second from the top there that says harmonious society in Chinese. So it's a fusion of old Confucian ideas of social harmony with principles of raising the standards of living for people in a fair and equitable way. Who oversaw China weathering the global financial crisis of 2008 and onwards? Who saw the successful undertaking of the Beijing Olympics in 2008 and the Shanghai World Expo in 2010? So all these are great achievements. Also the Chinese space program is beginning to take off under this watch. This period could be interpreted as China's coming out party. We see other symbols of the Hu era as quite a significant and positive time for the Chinese nation. So we see the Beijing Olympics were an example of this. We also see this personified in the image of one man, and that's NBA star, a former NBA star now, Yao Ming, who was able to make his mark as the first Chinese player in the NBA, and also act as a cultural bridge between China and the United States. Huge, huge personality in China. You can see signs of him everywhere. So all of this symbolises China's return to greatness after its long period of decline, a very significant achievement. But there are criticisms of Hu's administration. So one is that the shortcomings of his harmonious society doctrine, an increase in the incidence of mass incidents. So bottom right, the Wuhan village uprising from last year. Emblematic of that. Some have said that harmonious society has been a justification for cracking down on suppressing dissent. It's also been criticised that anti-corruption campaigns haven't really worked, and that corruption is still endemic across the hierarchy. They've been criticised for too many restrictions on freedom of speech. And he's also been criticised for having an overly aggressive foreign policy. So we see that the South China Sea dispute, or the East China Sea dispute with Japan, as signals of China's aggressive intentions. So that's very much debatable, and we don't really have time to go into that now. We might just skip over that. So let's evaluate now, just in the last couple of minutes. So Mao's accomplishments. He's a seminal figure in the story that I've gone through today. His accomplishments. He manages to unify China after a century of chaos, which is no mean feat. And he laid the foundation for China's modernisation and later economic growth, albeit in a haphazard and ideology-based way. He instituted universal healthcare for Chinese, which had never existed beforehand. So life expectancy for Chinese moved from 35 to 63 years. Literacy rates were increased over now from 7% to 80%, and the status of women improved remarkably. What about Mao's failings? Well, you can argue that he was a ruthless mass murderer. 70 million deaths could be attributed to his failed policies, which is a staggering number. It could be argued that he lacked any real feeling or sympathy with ordinary people. So he often fostered political tensions among his subordinates to preserve his power. The economy declined during his rule because of the nature of his policies, because of the anti-intellectualism, because of the inefficiencies of the command economy system that were running. So Mao's legacy is complex, as we can see. And the official verdict on Mao these days is that he was 70% right, 30% wrong. So there's definitely an acknowledgement that mistakes were made. But again, this man is such a central figure to the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party that they can't come out and say, they can't completely destroy his legacy, because they'll be destroying their own legitimacy to rule. So you can understand that this equation is the best that the Communist Party can do.